Hey Dave.
Hey, this is. Hey, Dio, how's it going?
Excellent. It's a little chilly, a little snowed under, but I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. I know all about your snow. I'm in Nashville right now. There's a beautiful hotel around me, a Days Inn. I don't know if I can get any money for endorsing it, but I do because I wanted to be here for 2 days, and I ended up being here for 3 days
Okay.
because there seems to be, correct me if I'm wrong, but some sort of snowstorm in
Yeah, it's
DC,
pretty rough. It's
and
pretty
it's
rough. DC got hammered. The government
yeah.
shut down. It's not open. The president has been snowed in along with everybody here in DC and most of the Eastern Seaboard. And so I'm home. But I did manage to make a journey out onto the road, much like Cormac McCarthy, to watch the Super Bowl, which is super exciting. I don't know if you caught the game, but I can't imagine that you didn't, as everybody in America watched. The New
I
Orleans
did catch.
Saints.
I caught the game in a Nashville bar full of New Orleans fans, like
Really?
really recent New Orleans fans. They became fans in the last 2 weeks, but everyone was quite excited about the victory. And I guess we're
Well,
not spoiling it. Yeah.
I'm not a football person, but I watched the game and cheered heartily for the New Orleans Saints, who won the Super Bowl over the Indianapolis Colts. Everybody knows now. But I just thought it was a really exciting. I mean, I was just with folks from DC, but it was universally the sort of thing where you wanted to root for the underdogs, the poor New Orleans Saints, who have won zero and now one Super Bowl championships in their franchise history since '67. And also, of course, there was the sort of solidarity of the post-Katrina victims having something good go on for their city. So I was there cheering for the Saints and glad that they won. But there's more than that happening in New Orleans, obviously. I mean, I've been following the mayoral race, which was the day before Saturday, for some time. And what I found significant about that election was how many candidates sort of threw themselves into the fray. It was very, I mean, there were 12 major candidates. I say 12 candidates, maybe six major ones by the end of it, all of whom sort of wanted to chart a new course after the term-limited C. Ray Nagin, made famous during the Katrina disaster for his less-than-ideal handling of it.
Famous or infamous, one of those. I
Right.
mean,
And
yeah, not one
so,
of most America's beloved mayors.
exactly. So Nagin's out, and Mitch Landrieu, part of a Louisiana political dynasty, is now the new mayor of the two-thirds black city that still, and I went down there in July, has hard work in front of it in terms of recovering from Katrina. But I, tying it back into the Super Bowl, I was really remarked that the president, had a Super Bowl watch party at the White House, and the only Republican who was there was An Cao, a Vietnamese Republican in the House of Representatives who represents New Orleans. And he must have been excited to see the Saints, but it's interesting to see what a newly Democratic white mayor will do to scramble the dynamics in the state. I don't know what your take is on that. I know he voted for the health care bill in the first round and has generally been stuck between a rock and a hard place for Obama's agenda. But what's your take on that race?
I mean, just in trivia terms, this is, as you said, a two-thirds black city, and it now has a white mayor and is represented, I think, fully all around the borders by a Vietnamese-American member of Congress. So that, I mean, I don't know what to make of that, but I think that's a, that, no, I do know what to make of that. That's kind of a sad statement on the political situation New Orleans was in before and after Katrina. Generally, if we go back to 2005, Mississippi had a Republican governor, Haley Barbour, who was really connected. Alabama had a Republican governor, Bob Riley, who was really connected. New Orleans, one, had a mayor who was not taken very seriously. Two, had this guy, Bill Jefferson,
Right.
who was beaten by Joseph Cal, because he was so corrupt and found with Cassius Razor. So, like, one of the compounding tragedies of Hurricane Katrina was that it just so happened to strike the city when it had completely deficient political leadership that couldn't get anything for it.
That's absolutely right.
So I mean, and I think that's underrated because the city really needed as much help as possible, and it went through, one, the hurricane, two, Nagin getting reelected in 2006 over Landrieu, and then, it got some help, but probably less than it could have if people thought it was this place
had a credible broker. That's right. I mean, what's so interesting now, is that Landrieu won with a sort of like, I mean, it was these races usually go to a runoff with what is being described as a multiracial coalition, and I think fairly, but sort of strangely, in that his turnout wasn't spectacular, but it was enough to get this guy over the hump. And what's striking about that, in addition to Cow's sort of representation of the district, is that it's just not, it doesn't seem that big a deal. I think people are really looking for someone who's not going to be sort of a racial grandstander, but someone who's actually going to sort of put their nose to the grindstone for New Orleans. And that's, you know, I had the chance to speak to one of the candidates, James Perry, who ended up losing pretty handily. But his whole sort of conception of the thing was that, look, you know, we've had black mayors for 30 years. Nothing particularly great has come of that. And people are ready for something new. And I think that that's sort of like a refreshing and sort of obvious development. But I wonder, you know, now that you have the sister of the mayor of New Orleans in the Senate, who knows how long she'll stay there, as well as a Republican governor, Bobby Jindal, who everyone's fairly familiar with, at least since last year when he delivered the rebuttal to the Obama's, or to the State of the Union, or whatever it was, the joint session of Congress.
The first one, last year.
The question is how much of a difference will strong leadership in New Orleans make in terms of sort of driving federal policy in general? And I think that there's a strong case to be made that Landrieu's election will do well for New Orleans, in that he's speaking for most folks, and who knows how much grumbling there is behind the scenes. But it's just a traditionally very corrupt, sort of city hall-oriented town, and Landrieu promises to clean things up, and yet is sort of part of the family machine. So it's something to watch, particularly as Jindal's up for a re-election next year.
I'm watching it because I've just seen a paradigm shift in the way that voters everywhere interpret their duty to their legislators, their mayors, their what have you, what they should be doing in term as a way of making their lives better, their city better. Because you know, Mitch's sister is Mary Landrieu, correct? And she's the three-term senator from Louisiana who, by most political science standards, done a pretty good job of getting, you know, using her leverage as a, you know, swing Democrat in this 59-seat majority, briefly 60, but now 59-seat majority, to get things for the state. But she ends up getting them and getting pilloried for that. Joseph Gao, as the one Republican who, in a very, very Democratic district representing this city, who will go along with Democratic policies and help marshal through bills that benefit New Orleans, also pilloried for this. I've really noticed that the political rewards for, you know, going to the mat and getting money for your state or helping pass a bill that's going to get, in Senator Landrieu's case, more Medicare funding for your state is not actually rewarded by political support back home. And that's been a surprise. I mean, that's never how New Orleans and Louisiana worked. The Long dynasty and other senators politicians who've been powerful in the state forever were powerful because they could bring things back to the state, which is always a little bit behind the rest of the country in what it could get. And now, you know, you've got a Republican who should have a lot of leverage, a senator who should have more leverage because her brother is mayor of New Orleans. And it's not actually a political benefit to bring things back home. I don't think will they stop doing that? I don't know. But right. I've watched Mary Landrieu like give speeches on the Senate floor apologizing basically for helping her state get $300 million of extra Medicare funding in passing this health care bill. And that's what – I don't know much about
– I think that's going to change. I really do. I mean, at least in this specific geographic case – I think there's going to be a lot of pressure, not necessarily on senators like Landrieu, but on representatives like on Cow, who's going to have a strong Democrat elected with a substantial mandate, with sort of juice, as it were, in a Democratic area, not allowing a representative to sort of vote down the sort of Democratic agenda and the priorities that would help a place like New Orleans and environs. And so maybe that will be a little bit of a boost to the Democrats representing that region in Congress. I'm not sure. But I imagine that between Obama sort of, you know, bringing him into the fold to watch the Saints and a strongly Democratic mayor sort of, you know, saying, why are you voting against these interests? He's either going to be out in November or get with the program. I mean, that seems pretty clear.
I mean, it's definitely better to have a strong mayor. That was one of the real tragedies of the last couple of years, is that the two most troubled cities we had were Detroit and New Orleans. And Detroit had a mayor in Kwame Kilpatrick who was totally beset by scandals, all of his own making.
Right.
You know, sex scandals, stupid things, and couldn't really put together the credibility to get what Detroit needed. Same thing in Louisiana, in New Orleans with Mayor Nagin, who was, you know, I think the impression is that he recovered a little bit of his credibility, but basically was seen as like a complete failure who had a nervous breakdown.
Yeah, I mean, he was a corporate guy. Yeah. He didn't really have a feel for New Orleans. He tried to sort of govern by fiat and did not bargain for the disaster that was Katrina, and so quickly lost popularity and, you know, is gone now, which I think is...
Yeah, but I don't know
but
how...
I'm just really pleased.
I wonder how this is going to work, because, I mean, I'm in this hotel room, which, unless you guys get a better video transfer than I do, looks very, very yellow and very bland, because I just finished covering the National Tea Party convention in Nashville.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to get out of this event with 200 members of the media, more than that, actually. By the end of it, I think it was like something along the lines of 250 members of the media, all talking to activists who represent in their minds and voices the mainstream of America, who think that government should really do nothing at all to help these things.
I have a question about that, because I'm fascinated by this, and I want to hear all about how the convention actually went. But I remember being in the Democratic convention in Denver and seeing these Pumas, these Party Unity My Ass Hillary Clinton supporters, who were furious that Obama had gotten the nomination and were there to sort of ruin things and start, you know, a ruckus.
I've just got, like, tons of media coverage,
there were not that many of them. But each of them had, you know, 20 reporters around them. It was a 1-to-20 ratio from what I could tell, which made the story seem bigger than it was. Would you say that's the case for the Tea Party convention?
It ended up being one to 2.5 or 1 to 3. Like, one reporter for 2.5 or 3 Tea Party activists at this convention. But that was almost a correction for the lack of reporters who'd shown up to previous Tea Parties, like the 9/12 march in Washington, and that was it wasn't quite a corrective because they'd missed those events. I found that reporters were asking these people at the event. I mean, not that I was listening in to every conversation they were having, but the ones that I heard, and you know, the ones that I reconstructed from having conversations after they were done interviewing, indicated they were just kind of asking fairly rote questions about why these people were so angry at the government.
Right.
You know why.
Right. I mean, is that their platform? Is it simply non-governmental? I know that was, 99th birthday of Ronald Reagan this weekend, and Sarah Palin mentioned him in her speech. Lots of folks were sort of jazzed about his vision for government and wanting to drown it in a teacup. Is that the single motivating force of these Tea Party types? I mean, what are they here for exactly? What did they want? I've been reading your writing, but I'd be curious to hear what the sort of the nut graph is.
Oh, man, I should have had a nut graph in that. That's a good point. I want to boil this down some. They basically think that America got off the right track 100-odd years ago. I guess actually 97 years ago, when Woodrow Wilson became president and the progressive movement started implementing huge reforms of the American system. You know, direct election of senators, progressive income taxes, the Federal Reserve, things of that nature. They think that ever since then, forget like the, you know, whether the stimulus didn't work or, you know, whether Obama doesn't really love America. They'll complain about those things, but they really think that both parties ended up confirming this system of meddling with what was right and good about America, and we all need to strip it way, way back to those fundamentals to prosper again. I guess it's that simple. They think the reason we're not prospering right now is because we have things like progressive income taxes and the Federal Reserve, and we're not on the gold standard. And I'm not sure how well this is reflected in coverage of the event. There was a lot of coverage about whether Sarah Palin was the leader of this thing or not. I cover Sarah Palin because I have to, but I can't help feeling...
As we all do.
I can't help feeling not like the little boy in the Emperor's New Clothes fable, like the little boy who gets it right and says that the Emperor is naked, but like one of the other people in the lineup who just stands there and nods like, there's the Emperor, he looks pretty good. I mean, I'm one of these reporters who just pretends that, like, you know, she is saying relevant and interesting and impactful things as a leader of this movement. She's kind of not. I mean, the movement is actually a bit more versed in history and more fundamental than her.
Right.
God, whatever
it sounds like it is. Little R conservative, mm-hmm. but not necessarily Republican, mm-hmm. if you see what I'm saying. Where it's sort of like, it's reactionary, it's against specific policies, but is not, and as we've seen in a couple of elections in 2009, not explicitly aligned with the sort of policies and general MO of the Republican Party. We saw that in the New York 23rd mm-hmm. race, which you covered spectacularly, where the Tea Party sort of messed things up for this Republican candidate and giving the election to the Democrat. So given that there's a specific set of policies that are oriented around, is there a sort of natural affinity with the Republican Party? Do you think that this will be something that will affect the way the Republican Party makes out in November? Or is it just going to cause a series of messy primaries that sort of ultimately end up disadvantaging the party with whom there may be the Tea Party might be most closely affiliated?
Well, one of the more interesting things Sarah Palin said was that she's in favor of more competitive primaries and contested primaries. And she's right. gone out of her way to endorse the more conservative or libertarian or Tea Party candidate in some of them. But I feel like, as fun as that is to talk about, these people are pushing on a door that's already open. It's not like the Republican Party, after they lost the election, was in danger of becoming less conservative. The Republican Party was always going to react to Democratic power by becoming more conservative. It's just that these people, had very specific demands, informed by a lot of stuff they're reading, informed by stuff that Glenn Beck said they should be reading about like what Republicans, if they get back into power, should do. And they're kind of new. I mean, when Republicans won in 2000, and they had the Congress and the White House and the Senate for a little while, and they got it back in 2006, like, it was understood they were supposed to cut government. They were also supposed to bring things back home. And the Tea Partiers are more motivated by the kind of Ron Paul sort of Republicanism, which says, you know, yes, you should be conservative, but you should also completely reject the idea of bringing anything home. Like, if you get the opportunity to bring some project that's going to help, you know, a New Orleans or a Columbus, Ohio, or a, you know, Youngstown or anything, right. You should step away from that hemlock and just trust in the free market to fix all these things. And that is, it's not really new, and it's something that a lot of Republicans, activists, thinkers, party leaders, whatever, have said, but it was something that wasn't seen as really politically viable until this movement. And now that, like,
this is my thing. Because this movement and this conference was sort of within the confines of the sort of movement itself somewhat elite, in that it was a paid conference, it was something people had to travel to come mm-hmm. to. Certainly people came to Washington on 9/12 to sort of express their distaste in the same fashion. But I just sort of wonder about the authenticity of this group and about the sort of real whether they actually have a voice and something that can actually move the needle on certain debates. Obviously, you know, there are a lot of folks that are increasingly connected by forces like the internet, by social media, by cable news, to sort of rally around things like Ron Paul advocated and things the Tea Party, you know, explicitly is advocating. Yeah. But I just wonder whether that translates into boots on the ground, whether you could call this an analog to Move On during the Bush years. I'm really skeptical of making that connection, simply because it seems that these folks are not, and the numbers vary, you know, but I just don't feel like they're a strong, connected movement that can change the game. If you look at what happened in Massachusetts, which I hope we can talk about in some length, the Tea Party wasn't a strong force, even though I know that former Governor Palin mentioned Scott Brown is a guy with a truck and a plan. You pointed out in one of your stories that this was someone who was fairly institutional, you know, had run for assembly, for state assembly, had worked with Mitt Romney on his campaign. And so I wonder to what extent the authenticity of this movement matters in terms of their efficacy.
Boy, yeah.
Whether or not you can just say, you know, we're anti-government, join the bandwagon, or whether or not, you know, they can really get people to come out and turn out the vote for their candidates in primaries or in general elections this fall.
Well, I mean, and Jonathan Martin had a good story in the Politico last week about other Tea Party candidates like Marco Rubio in Florida, who's seen as sort of the
right.
I was about to say Don Quixote, but that's not a good example. I guess like the William Wallace of the Tea Parties, like a real up from the grassroots hero who, if tortured on the rack, would totally take it and take one for the team, who actually is a protege of Jeb Bush and is supported by all these Republican consultants who matter.
And Sarah Palin, we shouldn't forget, went through the GOP's training program for women.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know if there really is a sort of pitchforked mob. I don't know if that exists.
Well, I mean, I one thing I noticed at this convention was that very few people there didn't want the Republican Party to take back Congress. And I talked to Justin Phillips, who ran this conference, and you know, one thing I noticed and I wrote a bit about is that even though in the lead up to this, one of the big stories was whether this guy Justin Phillips, head of Tea Party Nation, was collecting a profit and going to make money off this event.
Right.
You know, once the convention happened, people stopped caring. Yeah, you know, and talking a bit about the politics of this, I noticed he never really used the word Republican. He wouldn't say Republicans are going to win Congress. He would say conservatives are going to need to win Congress. He wouldn't say John Boehner is going to become the next Speaker of the House. He would say we can't wait until 2011 when Nancy Pelosi becomes the former Speaker of the House. And I kind of pointed this out, and he acknowledged that, paraphrasing the way he put it was that Republican, you know, like the important thing to do is get the Democrats out and give Republicans one more chance to take power and not screw up. But if they screw up again, they'll form a third party that forces them out. You know, that was what he said.
Here's
but for
question.
Like in the meantime, clearly their goal is to make the Republican Party less the party associated with George Bush, more the party associated with like random inchoate anger against the way the Democrats are running the country.
Okay, so why, I wonder, did this movement not develop during the Bush presidency? That's what I find so strange. It's not that people didn't feel that these principles were being violated by Republicans, because clearly on their face, several of these, you know, let's not tax and spend our government into extraordinary debt. Let's not, you know, for example, spy on individual citizens. Certain number of libertarian ideas are present in the sort of MO of the Tea Party as currently incarnated. Why is it now the sort of strenuous voice of opposition to the Obama administration, I wonder, and folks like Pelosi? Clearly, Democrats took back the Congress in 2006, but a lot of the things these folks are pissed off about were ongoing during the Bush presidency. So I wonder why even the sort of openness to partnering with folks like Boehner and Cantor, et cetera, in the face of what is sort of not really a change in policy, but a change in rhetoric, sort of like, you know, we're with the people, we don't want to explode the national debt, all these things Republicans were responsible for. Is it that these people are not informed, or is it that they're sort of, you know, by any means necessary, let's subvert democratic government? I'm just curious what your take is on that.
Well, you know, I find a different level of information and education on different issues. I think the people I talk to at these things are really conversant on, like, the Constitution and pretty conversant on what is in bills before Congress. But I do notice there's a lack of history about how conservative economics, supply-side economics, have worked in the recent past. There's a belief that every time you cut taxes and cut spending, the economy grows, and that's just kind of not true. I don't know why I said kind of. It's not true. The recession, when Ronald Reagan became president, was bad. He cut taxes. It got worse. He raised taxes. It continued to get worse and then got better. And basically, we got out of the thing because of, you know, Keynesian deficit spending. That's not the way that these people remember that history. They remember the history as being Ronald Reagan, who came in, you know, waving a flaming sword and riding a white horse, cut lots of taxes, and then the economy grew again. And it's weird because these people all lived through it. I mean, at this Tea Party convention, there was one speaker, I think it was Joseph Hara of World Net Daily, who really shouldn't have been on the stage, but let's avoid that discussion right now, who, you know, asked everyone who was born between 1946 and 1964, and, like, everyone raised their hand. I mean, it's a very middle-aged, very white movement. I mean, like, the only non-white people I met, basically, were either entertainers or people running for Congress. And they all lived through this stuff. They just choose not to remember that when these policies are tried, they don't quite work. So they've created this version of events I mean, it reminds me, I don't want to insult them because I talk to people all the time and I kind of like a lot of them, but it really reminds me of what hardcore, like, Trotskyites will say about how communism has never been tried. They use the same language about how, like, real conservatism has never been tried. Like, we've never really listened to the founders. And all these problems are because we let, you know, Marx whisper something nice into our ear and we tried some sort of system that didn't quite work. And I don't think it's really credible, but it's such a powerful motivating factor for all these people.
I mean, so these people are not that well informed, sure, and but feel strongly about whatever they believe. They're not that different from the average American voter. What I'm interested in is how this coalition grows, because you have a sort of, like, dedicated, hardcore group of folks who are going to support the party's agenda with money, with time, with feet on the ground. But I wonder where the coalition building comes in. And here's why I asked about the sort of motivations behind the group as far as you perceive them. I wonder, and it's great that you've mentioned these years between 46 and 64, if you extend a little further to 72, let's say, you have the sort of essential moment in which Richard Nixon was a political force in America, starting with it's a little after his election to Congress, but certainly during his vice presidency, his time in exile after running for president and losing, and then his rise to power is characterized by this sort of overbearing sense of grievance as a sort of primary motivation for X, Y, or Z political motivation. So accepting policy, as it seems like it's possible to do, where does a Tea Party find its natural allies? Are they the folks who are the white working class, who are upset about their station in life, who are upset about the changing civic space and the browning of America and immigration and these other issues? Or where is it just hardcore libertarian constitutionalists who are skeptical of government? I mean, I guess I'm asking to what extent does culture motivate and potentially expand this, we have to call, fringe political movement in...
That's a good question. I mean, I don't think culture as a as glue for a partisan movement is very new. And I think oppositional politics has always been part of what's put a movement together. I mean, Barack Obama's campaign seemed a lot more positive, and I think it was a lot more positive. But even if we look at the arguments he made, from when he made his Jefferson Jackson dinner in Iowa and the run-up to the caucuses, through the general election, it was positivity with a combination of attacks on, you know, Washington lobbyists, the old style of Washington, the old foreign policy class of Washington. And he got, you know, liberal activists kind of, you know, in the same boat of attacking the neoconservative class and the, you know, the political class that was running the city. So these guys are going to do the same thing. I mean, I know what you're talking about with culture. It's something that really disappoints me when I cover these guys.
Like, you interviewed Orly Tates, right? Like, Orly Tates was there. She's a birther. I mean, that is still part of the conversation.
That's what I was...
at this place. Will they shake that out in the end, or what?
you know, I've covered the birth certificate conspiracy people for a long time. Now, like, I'm not sure how much we need to regurgitate it for this conversation, but basically, there's been, for 2 years, right. basically, a contingent of, like, conservatives who think, like,
a bunch of crazy people.
Barack Obama, because he has a funny name and an African dad, must not have been born in America, and there might be some sort of alley-oop play they can play to disqualify from the presidency. And I've been writing about this for 2 years because I thought at first it was fairly amusing. I think now this is it's really depressing. And one, the lawyer who's gotten the most attention for suing all this stuff bought a ticket and was at the Tea Party convention, Orly Tate, this emigre turned American attorney from California. She was there and she was like shaking hands and doing media interviews. I didn't really force the issue with people, but it came up. Whenever it came up, you know, 4 times out of 5, people I talked to agreed that Barack Obama, you know, there's something fishy there, and he should have to show the proof that he's really American. You know, this is a way for them to frame. You know, if we're being really forgiving. Frame their worries about his commitment to American exceptionalism. If we're being less forgiving, a way for them to just be angsting and panicking about a president who's not a white guy, and that remains part of this. Like it's not something that one thing I noticed in the coverage of this event, which again had massive coverage I haven't seen really since the Democratic and Republican national conventions. Massive coverage, didn't really get into what the people actually thought. More, they got into what they said they thought, what they said they were angry about.
Right.
But there wasn't really investigation of, one, whether history is right, two, whether it was motivated by some sort of fear of the other and fear of, you know, the sort of, not just the other, but, like, non-powerful, non-white American.
The erosion of real America.
Yeah.
The erosion
yeah.
of real America. I mean, that's a legitimate fear. I mean, the census is happening this year, and boy, are people going to be surprised. Or if not surprised, at least, you know, uprooted from their sort of conventional ideas about
yeah.
where fault lines lie. I guess my understanding is that since Massachusetts, and I hope we can talk about what Sarah Palin
yeah.
said in her Q&A, because you were there and saw the whole thing, and I only saw what was replayed on the networks. This is not, I don't think that sort of the major disasters for the Democratic Party since Obama's election, of which there have been so many, I don't think that they translate into advantages for the Republican Party. And I would say that the Tea Party is an example of the way that it will not fully advantage the Republican Party, which, again, is still incredibly fractious as the sort of, you know, the loose confederation of totally crazy people. Sensible anti-government types, liberal perhaps even anti-government types, and sort of conventional Republican Party hacks. This still doesn't really translate to me into a coherent movement with strong leaders either in Washington or outside who can articulate an agenda to oppose what's been a carefully crafted, you know, over decades Democratic Party platform that is slowly moving through Congress. I just don't see the vacuum being filled by these disparate factions within the Republican Party, while acknowledging the vacuum is there. I think Democrats have done a pretty crap job of keeping their coalition together, of understanding the priorities that progressives have. I mean, I think I've read some recent criticism of the chief of staff, Rahm Emanuel, and some of the other political advisors in the White House for not understanding how important issues like the closing of Guantanamo Bay were to the base. And I think Republicans have done a good job of keeping the base of those folks at the Tea Party active, animated, whether for cultural or policy reasons. Democrats haven't, but I don't see what the end game is, even in November. I don't think that there's a clearly, you know, here's what we want, here's how we're going to get it kind of thing. And it's similar, I guess, to what you saw from Move On in sort of 2003, 2002, 2004. It was passionate, but it wasn't clearly articulated, and it wasn't able to make change. So I guess I'm wondering what the end game is, or whether you think Scott Brown's victory or anything else really indicates there's an opening here, as you mentioned, an open door for Republicans.
Well,
or conservatives,
I mean, halfway
generally.
Into your answer right there, I was I was gonna ask you about the move on and about, well, I was gonna ask you about that, but also about whether you think a political movement really needs to have something that they're proposing in opposition to what the party proposing. They really don't. I mean, the thing about Republican opposition right now is that, yeah, they're stopping big Democratic initiatives that would remake like the healthcare system, that would remake the law that we interpret to interrogate prisoners. But they're doing this because they have a different idea, because they want to maintain the status quo we have, or to get in there and, you know, pull down a few of the edifices of this and you know get you know. Bring down some of the reforms, some of the government involvement intervention, so that we do, like.
Oh, I think I don't know who it was. It might have been Mitch McConnell. He was like, "We need to break Obama."
Yeah, but
maybe that's really it. From where I sit, I see no political advantage, no political disadvantage for right now to just being like no. I mean, we've seen Shelby in Alabama be like, you know, just a huge killjoy and deciding to shut down the government just because he can. And there's no similar, I mean, there was no Republican, or Democrats were at least more restrained during the Bush era in doing this kind of just sort of wholesale cock blocking, but maybe it's not.
Well, that's the difference though, is that Republicans, Democrats want, and liberals want government to govern and to do things. And Republicans really don't. Marco Rubio, who we just mentioned before, who's
right.
Like a huge hero of the Tea Party movement and of this, you know, most of the Republican Party, to be frank, was on either Fox Business or CNBC. They kind of blur together in my head, although one is more serious than the other, and was asked what he would do right now if he was in – what Congress could do, actually, to slow down their session. He said, like, Congress could go on vacation or Congress could disband. And that actually is the model for conservative governance,
right.
Is not to answer what Democrats are doing with, like, a different policy, but to just not do anything. It's like when I worked at Reason Magazine for 2 years.
But
like,
this is what's,
you know,
yeah.
It was understood the best possible outcome in Congress for anything. You know, forget if you wanted a libertarian outcome. The best possible outcome was to just find some way for everyone to go home, and not resolve anything. So like this is brilliant.
Yeah, but
it's not just like a brilliant strategy. It's what they would like to do. I mean, if they could. Yeah.
I still don't see a political advantage to it. I know that right now we're talking about how Republicans are being incredibly successful as the party of no. All of the commentators known well to you and I are sort of saying, like, this is brilliant, great job shutting down government and making it look like the Democrats' fault. One of the most incisive pieces of campaign commentary I saw toward the end of the 2008 election was by David Frum, who's sort of, you know, positioning himself as a moderate, sort of, you know, St. Paul on the Road to Damascus, you know, critic in ways of the Republican Party of today. His story was in the New York Times Magazine, and it was about essentially the sort of lack of competence among Republicans as being the chief reason for the migration of well-to-do, formerly Republican voters from the Republican Party to the Democratic Party. And he was like, look, these are people who are highly functional, extremely efficient, executive types, who expect everything to work. They go to Whole Foods. They want the car doors to clank shut seamlessly. They expect an America that works. And it sort of highlighted the essential problem with wanting government to drown in a teacup, which is that on some level, you know, you need government to do things like prosecute wars and count the people for the census or everything else in between. And pretending as though that's not so sort of goes against the newly technocratic ruling class of America, who, you know, they like their iPhones to sort of never have interrupted service, and they get mad at AT&T when it does happen. And so government that is stupid and government that is dysfunctional is not actually the sort of aim. And that Obama, who was, you know, technocrat in chief, extremely efficient, ran this gangbusters campaign where everything worked, was an attractive choice because he represented competence, American exceptionalism manifested as competence rather than braggadocio. And that this group of folks, I thought when I read the article, would be reliable Republican voters for, or reliable Democratic voters, at least as long as Democrats were exhibiting an ability to govern. And maybe that's no longer the case. But again, I don't see how this sort of jump ball, where everything is sort of shot to hell in Washington, advantages Republicans who still haven't shown they have the propensity to get those groups. And I know that, you know, Scott Brown won independents. But I think nationally, I don't think you see independents sort of saying, well, I guess I better go join the Tea Party, or I guess I better join the Republicans. I don't see them winning this sort of argument.
Well, I mean, they don't say the voters don't say they're going to join Republicans, but the argument Republicans are making over the long run is that government can't do anything and should be limited from doing as much as possible. And it's, I mean, you bring up iPhones and iPads and various Steve Jobs miracles that are presented from time to time, and they don't think of those things in the context of things that humans can achieve, like the way government can achieve them. They're very separate. The Republican conception of this is that private companies can achieve these things, but government can't do that. You know, far from that. Government, if we allow it to work the way it's working now, is going to stop it in its tracks. And one thing, again, I really pay attention to at this convention that I've heard a lot of, but it was more obvious at this convention, was that there's a really clear narrative for conservatives and Tea Party activists and Republicans of how government and liberalism is responsible for a crisis that most people think, pretty accurately, was a result of deregulation of banks getting really greedy and chopping up bad mortgages into, selling them in ways that, like, didn't actually make sense. Like, in the Republican version of this, it's that liberals, for decades, starting in, like, the 1930s, peaking in the 1970s, had this plan to rig this system to benefit people who didn't really want to produce. You know, they wanted to pass a Community Reinvestment Act to make sure that people who couldn't afford homes had homes. And they wanted to basically, like, bring down this economic system and replace it with socialism. Like, that's the way this is conceptualized. And that, you know, if we want to identify only people who are Tea Party activists with that ideology, that's fine. I think it goes further than that. You've had a year now of Democrats running everything. And yeah, maybe media coverage has been unfair about that. But Democrats haven't really made a positive case that if you run, you know, if you really run the government with lots of money, lots of pump priming, using taxpayer dollars to fund projects, then you can get a better result than if you leave everything alone. So they've been basically, not arguing that they can do that, have seen the ground. And, like, I don't want to talk over you too much, but, like, I've noticed in the last week and a half, 2 weeks, since the Massachusetts election, that when Obama talks about the debt, instead of talking about this as, you know, the way that liberal and Keynesian economists have talked about it forever, he kind of acknowledges that, no one likes having debt. Families live within their means.
Yeah, that's something that people have been hugely critical of, and I think justifiably so. Basically, what you've just said makes it completely clear to me why Sarah Palin is a champion of this group of individuals and the narrative that you described. Because this is a woman who, as we now know, has written, on her hand her chief principles for governance because she couldn't keep them in mind. So maybe the sort of government will never work narrative can only be championed by someone who would be incapable of running the government. I mean, maybe it's some sort of, like, Jedi mind trick that I haven't really been able to understand what her appeal. But if the narrative is that there's no, that we could just put a monkey in there, then okay, then great, then she's your gal. But I just would strongly disagree with the perception that Democrats can't govern. I mean, Republicans have been extraordinarily helpful to that narrative in that they've stopped everything from happening. But again, I'm not sure. The messaging has been abysmal until now. But I'm not sure that before November, Democrats will not be able to articulate a vision of America in which Republicans are in the room. I mean, they're in the room every day when these things are going down in flames. And the reason they're going down in flames is because of Republicans. Now, the White House hasn't been able to raise the costs of this disaster for Republicans, but I think they might be able to in the long run. I mean, if there's a chain of evidence where you have a line of votes, where you have Republicans voting down this, that, or the other thing, and then, as Obama pointed out in this sort of widely publicized chat with the House GOP a week ago, where they go to these ribbon cuttings for these projects they voted against and slip their earmarks into, you know, defense reauthorization bills and then decry pork, or vote against plain vanilla credit cards, 175-0, and then sort of talk about wanting to help people deal with this crisis. It'll start to look fake. And maybe that's just my optimism in Democratic messaging. But, I mean, that's what's happening. And hopefully this narrative will start to become clear to the average American. I don't really put much stock in the trade that you and I participate in for clarifying any of these things.
Yeah.
But that is what's going on, and I just don't know that pretending that stopping government entirely is, that can't possibly, I mean, if that's really the end game, then I think Republicans will lose out, because you can't just grind to a halt and then keep, it can't be sustained, I guess is my point. And sooner or later, those costs will sort of come out. I mean, do you not think that's the case? Can they just keep doing this until Obama's out?
I used to say, yeah, because just, this is not a country that has a lot of faith in government. It hasn't in a very long time. It didn't when Bill Clinton was president. It didn't when Barack Obama took over. It had distrust in government, in business, and in government. But, I mean, there's a few things that I think the White House has been really bad at that don't reflect what people think the government should be doing. I mean, I think voters generally believe that the government's able to, like, fill out every position within the federal structure, you know, U.S. attorneys and deputy assistant secretaries of what have you. And in the last 2 weeks, I think, less than that, it's really since Thursday or something, this Senator Richard Shelby's holds on, was it 70 nominees? That he's put a hold on in order to get leverage for his earmarks. Like, that has created, I think, for the first time, a argument for the White House to make that the obscure rules of the Senate, instead of being things the founders wisely put in place to make sure we don't make rash decisions, have become things that stop the government from working properly. But, you know, they've had a couple of these opportunities to make that case, and they haven't really used it. I'm sympathetic. I mean, I don't really like a lot of the policies they've been trying to implement. I'm sympathetic with the idea that the president should win an election and appoint lots of people. And I'm pretty confident that they've done a bad job of making that case so far. So I want to see, I'm watching this to see if they can push back successfully against that without sounding whiny. If they can make the case that, yeah, even if you want small government, you should be for letting us fill this thing out. But they haven't pushed very hard. Now, like, I covered George Bush not as close as I covered Barack Obama, but George Bush was always really good at staging partisan firefights over some guy who was nominated to fill, like, some position in the State Department or some circuit court or district court slot. Obama doesn't really do that. And so, like, it's like issue after issue where Obama doesn't, since Obama doesn't fight and make this case that I think you're pretty confident making, and most smart liberals in Washington are confident making, it's just like all of the ground is ceded to the Jim DeMintz and Michelle Bachmanns of the city.
Okay, it's deeply frustrating. Mm-hmm. I have to think that on the merits, Democrats are right, not about the policy, but about the process. And the reaction to that probably should be a little more neener than, you know, a hand outstretched.
Yeah.
And yet, you know, we're hearing that the president is having another, like, bipartisan meeting on healthcare this week. And I just don't understand why no brawling? You know, what's the problem here? Why can't you just sort of stick the shiv in? You've got this reputation from your chief of staff of being kind of like, you know, this arm twister. None of that is happening. I think the White House was really proud of the president's performance in front of the House GOP and sort of made a point of sort of pushing that narrative that, you know, Obama, you know, not only can he talk without notes on his hand, but, you know, he can make these guys look silly.
Mm-hmm.
Will more of that start to happen? I don't think that'll happen from the Congress. I mean, all those folks at the corresponding Democratic conversation a few days later with the Senate, it was these sort of embattled incumbents, folks like Blanche Lincoln in Arkansas, probably going to lose. You know, Harry Reid maybe will lose. Evan Bayh now is being primaried, or will have a challenger from the Republican side. All these folks are, you know, as Obama said in his State of the Union speech, running for the hills. And I don't understand why that's good politics. From a policy perspective, it's obviously disastrous. But from a political perspective, it doesn't seem smart. Clearly, the thing to do would be to pass health care and then to defend it. Because it's popular when you explain it to people. But I just don't see why Democrats are so willing to capitulate. And maybe that's not a question for you, but just a general problem with the sort of Washington thing that Obama ran against. But it's just incredibly disheartening, and it just makes me sort of wonder why you would even want to be part of this gang. I'm reminded of an essay that, you know, Jacob Weisberg wrote this week, because we had the chance to chat about it a little bit at a panel that we were both on in New York City, essentially just saying that the whole thing was not the fault of the sort of the poobahs in Washington, but the fault of the American people for not knowing what they want. And the argument is essentially the problem with California is now national, where folks there, you know, vote for something like the three strikes rule, and then they don't realize that it's going to cost, you know, X amount of money to build new 14 new prisons to hold all these prisoners. Similarly, on the national scale, people are like, you know, well, we really would enjoy if we had, you know, these social safety net protections and unemployment coverage and, you know, maybe healthcare. We're kind of open to it. But we definitely don't want government to get any bigger, and we're definitely not into spending. And we sure want America to be safe, and we like these wars, kind of. We're ambivalent about them, but we definitely don't want the debt to go up. So there's some fundamental hypocrisy on the part of the American voter that is more to blame than the stupidity or various sort of craven behavior of Democrats or Republicans in Washington. And I agree with it a little bit. I feel bad blaming the, you know, average Joe. But as you talked about the Joes at this Tea Party and all across the country, they're not, you know, super informed. So can we blame these folks?
I really like blaming these folks. I really do. I mean, I think we've actually got a pretty good system set up for politicians to be unresponsive and to make harder choices. And if the Senate worked like a real political institution, you know, having 6-year non-consecutive, not well, not consecutive, but like 33 people at a time serving 6-year terms, acting as independent actors, should be enough.
Right.
To do all this. But because the Senate's really moronic, instead of being like that, you end up having 100 autonomous individuals who get to act like little kings of their fiefdom, block whatever they want, and, you know, become celebrities. And it's pretty clear to me why, you know, pretty clear to me why the institutions we have are letting Americans get away with this, and like, and why really the Senate in particular has become just such a place for grandstanding instead of a place for being able to cool these emotions Americans have and explain to them carefully, like, you know what, I understand you're worried about the deficit, but here's the long-term picture. Or, you know what, like, I understand you're all hitting the phones about immigration, but it's actually not true. They instead all become like huge panderers who are using their power to, you know, to be the first to. I mean, I think going to the Senate and not being able to achieve things, or at least like being able to achieve lots of insignificant stoppages of things the president wants to do, they make lots of sense if you want the job for some celebrity status. And
yeah,
you know, I've been paying, especially because I was in Nashville all weekend, I've been paying lots of attention to Harold Ford's attempt to make a comeback as a brand new type of politician in a brand new state that he's never lived in before.
What did people there think of him?
What did you say?
What did people there think of Harold Ford?
Well, I mean, this is a conservative conference. They never liked him in the first place, but, you know, they're aware that this guy who ran for Senate in 2006 and got, you know, 48% of the vote or whatever, running as a conservative Democrat, is now running around New York talking about how pro-choice he is and how he's for gay marriage. And they all kind of view it as a farce. I mean, they just, you know, what's the phrase Obama used by Jeremiah Wright? This is not the Harold Ford they knew. They know this guy. and his family and his policies, and just they're watching him kind of with amusement, try and pretend he's not like this at all. It's like watching, you know, it's like, you know, remember when Garth Brooks? Why did I say remember when? Of course, no one remembers this. But when Garth Brooks created like a fake character,
yeah,
and made an album and a movie out of him, they had, like that. No one brought that up, but I kind of wish they did. So I could put my story. They're all just laughing more than bring up obscure Garth Brooks.
Right.
Yeah, but everyone thought it was a huge joke. I mean, do you not feel like Harold Ford's reinvention as whatever the heck he is now is just kind of a cosmic joke?
Well, he's done a lot of stupid things. You know, I'll just say from the bat, I think, you know, he might pull it off. I think if there's any state he could carpet bag his way into federal office, it would be New York State. But he's not helped himself by a series of blunders that have been well cataloged to date. The first was his interview with the Times, where he said he had only been to Staten Island on a helicopter. Another one was his Colbert Report appearance, where he just sounded like completely unprepared to defend his flip-flopping, which, you know, Stephen Colbert, while he's a jokester, does actually sort of get to the meat of things at certain times. And the final straw, at least if you're keeping score, was a Maureen Dowd interview that ran in the Sunday New York Times, where, you know, he defended his getting pedicures and just sort of generally being not of the people of New York State, no less New York City. And
yeah, I mean, it doesn't even seem like he knows there's a state beyond New York City.
I know.
And he's always referring to
exactly.
How... Like, the phrase that always comes up in these interviews is that he loves how New York smells. And that's great. I assume he's talking about
Manhattan.
The New York City subway, and not like...
Which he's barely
not
taken.
Like horse farms in Poughkeepsie and stuff.
Exactly.
Which
and
are
I mean,
nice. Well, I mean, there's lots of nice horse farms.
I mean, what I also stood out in that Dowd interview was his description of what I thought was a clear sort of abandonment of any future political ambitions in Tennessee. I mean, he really made a clean break when he talked about how he's in this interracial marriage and how, you know, they chose New York because Tennessee wouldn't look kindly upon it, which is probably accurate. And he was, you know, in all of these sort of, like, blunderous, catastrophic interviews, he's been quite sincere. I wouldn't take that away from him. I mean, he seriously does think that, you know, he had to be pro-life in whatever way he's defining it in Tennessee, and he did have to sort of be, you know, anti-gay marriage in Tennessee. These are all factual. It's the case that these are, you know, that it's true that he had to hold these positions. The question is whether or not they will be forgotten come November, whether you're going to see ads, you know, from whatever opponent, you know, runs against him if he makes it through the primary, saying, you know, well, remember when he said this about Staten Island? Remember when he sort of talked about getting pedicures? And I don't think it's a big problem in Manhattan. Certainly, you know, he's got the right folks backing him there. But...
I mean, are they the right folks? I thought they were all basically like bank and real estate investors that were backing
yeah,
him.
Yeah, and you know what? That's what counts. If you need to fundraise against an incumbent, I think that it's important that you have these kind of connections. It doesn't help that he worked for Merrill Lynch. But ultimately, this is going to be a story of the primary, right? I mean, Gillibrand is brand new. She's someone who was essentially sort of foisted upon the New York voters by an unpopular governor who may or may not resign imminently in the next 12 to 24 hours, David Patterson.
I only started to hear about this just now, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, we will follow that story closely as it breaks blogging heads. But look, I mean, he's got an opening, and I think he might take it, and I think he might do well with it. I mean, what you need is name recognition, and you need cash. And I think if he can make an affirmative case for basically more of the same for New York with a little bit more sort of, you know, protection for bankers, he could win over some folks upstate New York. I mean, they're not the sort of same Republicans as the Republicans on the Upper East Side of Manhattan, but he could make a credible case coming from Tennessee and being a little more moderate than Gillibrand. And I think, like... the state of the Democratic Party now, there is a bit of a vacuum. And I think the person to watch is Chuck Schumer, who, and I didn't read all of Game Change, even though, just on principle, but one of the things that I
read
sort of noted...
It on principle. I love it.
One of the things I noted from the excerpts I read was that Chuck Schumer was so quick to sort of to jump ship from Hillary to Obama as soon as it became politically expedient. And right now he's got to stand by his colleague in the Senate, and rightly so. I mean, she hasn't done terribly for herself. She's not exciting, but she's not, you know, she's not dumb. But I think the primary is going to be the important thing, and it will be perhaps a replay of the 08 series of primaries we saw between Clinton and Obama. I don't want to make the analog too too strong. But I do think that whoever they run against in November, the Democrat is likely to win. And if he takes a piece out of her in the primary, which I think he might be able to do, you know, he could pull it off. I don't see that being implausible, even though right now he's
struggling with himself. I guess I've seen polls that show him getting, you know, 20-some percent of the vote against her in a trial heat. I think he'll peak there. I mean, I can totally see this becoming an election where she gets 65% of the vote and he gets destroyed and humiliated. Not that it would end it. I mean, he's just got such an ego that I think we'll hear him mentioned as a possible candidate for something or other the rest of his life. Because, you know, as long as we're in this hyper-partisan situation where you need a massive majority in the Senate to achieve anything, like, forget the House. Like, it turns out you can pass any bill in the House. It doesn't matter because Ben Nelson's going to whine about it in the
right.
Senate. Ford's argument seems to be that he's really charismatic and he's independent. And independent, actually, sounds great. And I guess that's how you win an election in another state. But, like, if you're a liberal in New York, you don't want independence at all.
Yeah.
You basically want, like, a bunch of, like, wind-up dolls who are going to vote for the Obama agenda.
And that's Joe
and
Brown.
Like,
that's his main argument against her, is, like, I'll be, you know... And it's such a... I mean, he's not just running for the Senate. He's running to be an important senator. Let's not forget that. I mean, that might be part of the allure. It's like, if I get in, I'm going to vault to Lieberman Nelson Snow status by being controlled
about
the
banks. Yeah, that's the opposite. I mean, I don't... It's like, I guess it's a good test of what... of if voters are complete idiots or not. Because if you're a liberal New York voter, I mean, if you're like a Manhattanite, Carolyn Maloney...
Who's being primaried.
Any primary voter, you don't want influence. I mean, you know, Daniel Moynihan was influential, but if you were a liberal, he was terrible.
Uh-huh.
Because he was like an intellectual superstar who was, you know, pulling all the planks out from under the platform on healthcare reform.
Right.
Like, you want... I mean, this is what Republicans are very good at. Republicans had lots of various opinions in their majority, and... You know, personalities would clash with each other, but at the end of the day, they would all get on the same boat and back, you know, whatever judicial nominee George Bush had or whatever tax cut he wanted. And they would let a couple of guys get away with, you know, but, like, independence was not prized because
right.
independence at the federal level basically means, you know, destroying the agenda that millions
That's
of people
right.
work to get. Yeah, I don't quite get it.
I mean, Democrats
Harold
Ford's
shouldn't allowed
want
to be a politician
to
the way, like,
And I
Democrats
think it's really
what?
Interesting. I mean, Democrats shouldn't want Ford to run or win for exactly the reasons you've described,
no.
which is that party discipline is hard enough for them already, and they just do not need some, like, you know, Obama monkey thinking that he's hot, you know, stuff in the Senate. That's just not what they need right now or next year. So maybe that's a reason for some of the folks like Schumer and some of the more established Democrats in the party to rally around Gillibrand. But I don't fault him for thinking he can get his scrubbed toe in the door and, you know, really make a splash in the race. And given what happens if and when Patterson resigns or whatever, and, you know, whoever it is in the White House political shop that was already interfering in New York state politics back in the fall continues to decide to put their thumb on the scale, you could see things changing for him significantly. So he's not dumb, you know. He wants to be back in the game. But he could very well turn out to be kind of a John Edwards, where he didn't do much when he was in the House. He apologized for a bunch of stuff, became an also-ran, and then became kind of a joke. Not certainly one as tragic and comic as Edwards, but it could just be one of those things where he's always mentioned, but never the bride.
I can see that. I mean, he is a good TV personality, and that's like a tragedy, I think, of the Democrats is that they really don't have any... you notice this when Obama came to the House GOP meeting in Baltimore. He's talking to Mike Pence and to generic Republican X or generic Republican Y, and you realize that, like, for a majority party, the Democrats are severely lacking people who can, you know, you'll see them on Hardball or on a Sunday show, and you're like, oh, sweet, he's there. He's going to kick that guy's ass. Whereas Republicans, because they're all pretty unified, even if they're mediocre, like, you know, Mitch McConnell is just, like, a terrible spokesman for his party.
Right.
he's at least going to stay on message. Like, Democrats, the most charismatic people they have, forget Harold Ford, people like Russ Feingold and Ron Wyden and the various stars of the Senate and the House are just kind of like loose cannons.
Yeah.
Who want to cut their own path.
Right.
And, I mean, I guess I'm going around and making an argument now for parties being composed of G.I. Joes who don't really have any opinions apart from what, like, is passed from above. But that's kind of how that's supposed to work.
Yeah.
If you're gonna have something that's based not on a majority, but on, you know, a majority one house, a supermajority another, a bill that can pass through a series of hoops and then get approved, you kind of just need everyone to shut the hell up and go along with that. And
keep it moving. Keep it moving.
You do. Like, if you have a star, the only point of having a star is having one like Jim DeMint on the Republican side who's going to bring everyone to the right. Like, having a star who's going to take pride in, right, you know, challenging the agenda of the majority, that's the point, especially because it's not like the majority, like, what the majority wants to do is that obscure or that far from what liberals have always wanted to do. Like, Harold Ford hasn't pointed out things that Democrats want to do right now that Democrats haven't wanted to do since Harry Truman. I mean, he's made these, like, really trite arguments about how healthcare is unpopular because Scott Brown won. And again, I was in Massachusetts. I think if Martha Coakley had, like, any red blood in her veins, then we wouldn't be talking about this. But, you know, I see what the function of having a Democrat who sees the party suffer or lose an election and says, oh, well, you know, we should just give up on our agenda because it's more important to, like, elect some guys than it is to get anything done. Yeah. Like, that's not how... I don't think the Republican Party has been the most successful party in American history. Obviously, it was the Whigs. But, like, in power, they were willing to take all these cyanide capsules in order to get policies passed. Like, it was very clear to everyone in the Republican conference in 2007 that if they kept voting with George W. Bush and voting to fund the war, voting for his budgets, they were going to lose elections. And they just voted for those things, lost elections.
You know, that's right.
And
that's,
they're all gone now, but like...
That gives me some sort of newfound respect, maybe, for the Republican Party. Party discipline is
as
large a part of politics as a legit platform. Obviously, they're weighted differently, but when push comes to shove, maybe one is more important than the other. You know, get your ducks in a row, but then, like, make sure something happens. Otherwise, you're going to get called out. Like, Democrats are about to get called out in November. I don't know. I will be watching these races closely,
I mean,
Dave. Maybe we should wrap up. We've already sort of been rapping for a while on all of these things, and I know you have an early flight back to the snowpocalypse. I will shovel myself out.
I'm told.
By God. I will do it.
And there's more snow expected. There is snow expected this week, right?
Yeah, no, it does not stop. It's going to continue to. I mean, what's sad about this is, like, school lunches are being cut for kids because D.C. has exceeded its snow budget. Go Mayor Fenty. I think everyone's really jazzed about that. But it's been...
Oh, man.
Yeah, no, exactly. Those poor children. But it's been a complete...
I suddenly feel so sad for making fun of how government works. I really regret that now. Yeah, no, this is terrible. Everything's pretty terrible. I think we could have just said that the first 5 minutes and gotten this over.
Yeah, exactly. Well, let's just have a snow day. Certainly the government is having one. We'll see if it lasts through November. Maybe they'll get back to work sometime soon.
I mean, I at least hope that if people watch this blogging heads with their heads really close to their laptops and or desktops, that warmth is going to help them through whatever blizzard is affecting their area of the country.
Right?
So I think we did a good thing.
We did a good thing. Well, thank you, everybody, for watching. Dave, a pleasure. I'll see you soon, no doubt, back in the swamp.
Oh,
yes. But until next time.
Oh, thanks so much, Dio. Yeah.
Bye, folks.